This episode is brought to you by Dashable, an app to help you find deals, discounts, and coupons for local businesses in New York City.
Time for Lunch is a new podcast from HRN for curious young eaters, where we focus on the serious questions.
Aren't chickens tiny dinosaurs?
We get to know our favorite foods in unexpected ways.
We just like cheered like you would cheer for your classmate when they're rounding second base in softball. And we just like, peach, 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 peach. Yay, thank you, peaches.
Learn some new recipes and jokes.
What does a boxer's mom put in his lunch? A knuckle sandwich.
And load up on fun facts.
Experts estimate that there are between 1 and 2,000 types of insects eaten around the world.
So roll up your sleeves and dig in. Subscribe to Time for Lunch on your favorite podcast app so that you and your favorite young eater can catch up on the whole first season. New episodes of season 2 out each week.
Well, hello. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. This is the 259th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a top luxury hospitality professional, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip. And then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to be kind to yourself and make you the priority. Focus on self-care, from your health to your mind and lifestyle. Understand that it's not being selfish to put yourself first, but rather it's necessary to then be able to take care of others. If we don't put our own needs in the forefront, we simply can't be of service to anyone else. So let's remember to treat ourselves with the utmost care and kindness so we can then spread our love. That's my tip today. Now, this is very exciting. I am thrilled to have my guest on the show with me. It is Gary Obligacion. He is the general manager at Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California. Gary has enjoyed a career in luxury hospitality spanning more than 30 years, from the famed Chez Panisse in San Francisco's Ritz-Carlton and Mandarin Oriental, and to being recruited by Coast Luxury Management to run its food festivals like Pebble Beach Food and Wine. Prior to Big Sur, Gary was director of service operations for Chicago's Alinea Group, including its namesake Michelin three-star rated restaurant, Alinea. So welcome to the show. Hi, Gary.
Hi there, Sherry. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
You know, all things considered, I'm doing well. I'm living in Big Sur. I can't complain.
Let me tell you, in my research and everything I know about Big Sur and where you are at, I'm quite jealous of your location.
You're not alone. I look up some days. In order to see the Pacific, I have to actually sit up in my bed. And it's one of those that I understand on a daily basis how lucky I am.
Yeah, it just looks, it's so gorgeous. And I've been fortunate to be out in California before, previously into Monterey at the Pebble Beach Wine and Food Festival, but I definitely have not spent a good quality amount of time in Big Sur. And I just want to get on a plane and come visit you.
Well, perfect. Let's make that happen.
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, when we can, because now, yeah, times are uncertain, but I hope to get out there in the future. And let's talk about Yeah, let's talk about everything that's happening. But first, let's. Oh, I always like to start with my guest background. Just find out like where you grew up and what was it about food or hospitality that you decided that's what you wanted to do with your career.
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, California, so I'm a native Californian, which is not a thing you hear very often.
True.
And I grew up in an environment where my mother worked for IBM, my father was an attorney, and I was an only child. So it was one of those where I just grew up around, you know, doing my homework at the kitchen table. My mom would come home, and I became a prep cook in the household. I'd help peel shrimp or chop onions or whatever it was while I'm in the course of doing my homework. Fast forward to when I went off to college, I went to UC Berkeley, and a friend of mine in the dorms had his mother visiting, and I said I was looking for a job, and she said, well, you should go apply at Chez Panisse. And I had no idea what Chez Panisse was, having come from LA. It just wasn't on my radar at that point in 1984. And I went over and applied for a job, and I got it, and I got $5 an hour cash. And I got, you know, a meal at Shea every day. And it was, I didn't realize what it was doing, but it really planted the seed for the fact that I was doing something fulfilling and sustainable and that I fell in love with. And I never went back. I thought I wanted to be a doctor. I just chose a different way. Instead of being in hospitals, I went into hospitality.
Well, yeah, that's quite a start to work with Alice Waters and kind of, I guess, stumble upon Chez Panisse. But yeah, I could see how you might get the bug to work in the industry from that. So then from there or post-college, take me through a little about the work you did with hotels. And then I know you were out in Vail at one point.
Yeah, it's a 36 years. Wow, that's a lot of years now. 36 years in the industry, on and off. But at first, I wasn't sure, and I was cooking for a little bit. And a friend of mine was like running off to Mammoth Lakes, and I'm like, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing, so why not? I'll shoot up there. Got a job at a chart house as a broiler assistant, and I was, you know, doing baked potatoes and, you know, and carving the prime rib. But then they trained me to be a bartender, which was a good thing. I got a job from there working in a restaurant under Chef Ian Algaron. And Ian had been the executive sous chef at what was the California Culinary Academy. And he was cooking in a restaurant in Mammoth called Novato's. And he brought me in and taught me to cook. And I learned kind of from the ground up. I had to learn garmage, had to learn sauces, had to learn pastry, had to learn saute because I knew the grill first. So my education was kind of backwards. I went from there to San Francisco, was cooking at Boulevard Restaurant, and then jumped the wall to become a waiter at Boulevard. And then I went to the Ritz-Carlton San Francisco, where I started management. And that was my first foray into five-star, five-diamond environment, but they really taught me the basics of management. I stayed in San Francisco for a few years, ended up being recruited by Pebble Beach Resorts to come down here, was with Pebble Beach Resorts from where I went to Bernardus Lodge. And then there was this inkling or this word of an event that was starting that was going to be what became Pebble Beach Food and Wine, which really was an extension of the Masters of Food and Wine, which is around before it for, I think, 22 years. And as it was launching, I said, I have to be a part of it. I went to launch there as the vice president in charge of operations and logistics, and really just built that event. I was the third employee and was there, I think, to my recollection, I think it was 127 days before the first event. And it was mind-blowing how much we didn't have in place before that first year's, and had wild success. From there, yeah. I left the company. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, I ended up in Vail only because, you know, the event world, as fun as it is, it's only You know, you spend a whole year getting ready for a four-day event. And for me, the most fun part is the operation. And it was not as fulfilling. So I followed a friend of mine who was launching a property, and he was the opening GM for a reconcepting of a hotel in Vail called the Sebastian. He brought me on board to help launch his food and beverage operations, and I stuck around as the resort manager. So I was in charge of all rooms division and all other operations as the number two, basically the executive assistant manager rooms division. I would have probably stayed there indefinitely because you get this wonderful, you know, Monday through Friday type lifestyle. I could ski any day I wanted to, you know, ski in, ski out kind of operation. But I got a phone call from Grant Achatz, and that sent me. When Nick Akonis and Grant Achatz call you from the Alinea Group in Chicago, you listen and take that phone call. And I ended up out there for 5.5 years.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, you do take that call, and that's an amazing history. And I was trying to think when we met, if it was at Pebble Beach or it was at Alinea. But, you know, I've been, or it was, you know, it was probably at an event somewhere in the middle of that, because I didn't get out to Pebble Beach Food and Wine until 2017, but
no, the first time I met you was actually Chef's Night Out during the Jay's Beard Awards.
Oh wow, you have a good memory. yeah, okay, that's when we met, and yep. And it's been such a pleasure to, you know, see you all these years and get to know you just through being a part of the hospitality industry, and then when I went to. I got out to Alinea when you were there. I don't think you weren't there that night, but you knew I was coming in, and I had such a special experience dining there. So what was like the biggest takeaway or something like lesson learned or from working with Nick and Grant?
I'd say there's a couple of very distinct lessons that I learned while there, and one of them is that if it could be better, you should make it better. And it's really looking at that constant improvement and every day walking in and assessing and judging yourself, not just what you're doing, but just tweaking it consistently. The other part I would learn in that environment was that there is not a single detail that isn't important. And that was an eye opener because it in all of our operations, it doesn't matter what you're doing. It can be, you know, hotel, restaurant, accountancy. It really doesn't matter. You really want to focus on how you do every aspect and be conscious about it and not take it for granted. And if you decide to do something a certain way, either you know it's there and you continue, or you know it's there and you don't like it and you change it. And either one is valid, but knowing it exists is the key part. I guess the final thing I would learn from there was that just there's no finish line. And especially in hospitality, we come across this, but it's, you know, you have guests come in today, they come in, they have a wonderful experience, and those guests leave tomorrow, it's a brand new set, and you do it over again. And it's a lot, to a large extent, it's wash, rinse, repeat. And it just continues going on a day-by-day basis. The challenge is to keep it fresh for all parties concerned. For, you know, the customers, obviously, you want it to be fresh and new and exciting for them. But for the staff that's also executing and doing and delivering that product, it's important. For management, owners, investors, it has to stay vibrant and alive from all points of view, well, no matter what the product.
Yeah, very true. So you're there, you said 5.5 years, and then the West Coast was just calling your name. Were you just ready to for a change, or how did you post ranch in that your position as general manager come about?
Strange story. So as I was leaving Coastal Luxury Management and stepping away to see what was next, I didn't have a plan. I didn't know what was next. And a lot of my friends here in the Monterey Peninsula tried to convince me to stay, just to stay in the Carmel, Monterey area, because it's for all kinds of reasons. my response at the time was that there really wasn't anything that I wanted to do from a career standpoint. There was no job that was calling out to me. But I made an offhand comment to one of my friends. I said, you know, I'd stick around to be, I don't know, general manager of Post Ranch Inn. Fast forward 7.5 years, and the person that I said it to called me and said, remember when you mentioned being general manager of Post Ranch Inn? I'm like, of course I did. And she said, well, the job's open. Do you want me to reintroduce you to the owner, Mike Freed? And I said, well, I have to say yes. And really, it was one of those when the universe screams at you like that, just shouts at you, you have to listen. I thought I was going to be in Chicago forever. I was in a dream job. And then when this opportunity presented, I had to at least entertain it and come talk to them. So I left a dream job for another dream job is really kind of what it ends up being.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was also thinking what's that saying when like you put out to the universe what you want and then it will come. And like you put out there that if there was this position there, I'd take it. And what do you know?
Yeah, I had to say yes. At least I had to entertain it.
Right. So for people who haven't been to the Post Ranch Inn, can you describe it a bit? Because I'm just looking around on your website and it just looks so magical.
Well, okay, so California, for those who haven't been, is one, it's a really enormous state, and it has all these different little microclimates throughout. The two areas that most people are familiar with, or the two major cities, are Los Angeles in Southern California and San Francisco in Northern California. And of course, those are very different from one another. If you're driving the coast of California between the two, if you're driving Highway 1, about one-third of the way down from San Francisco on the way to Los Angeles would be Monterey Carmel area, right? And that's a beautiful, majestic little area, a little cute town. About, you know, 30 miles south of that is Big Sur. And you drive through Big Sur. There is no actual town per se. There's a post office, but there's no town. It's a drive-through area. It's untouched country. It's hard living. It's where the ocean meets the mountains. They're right here. And you're driving Highway 1 in this area, and you have a combination of these soaring mountains on one side and then Pacific as far as you can see on the other. We have, at Post Ranch Inn, just under 100 acres of land on the Pacific side of Highway 1, but there's only 42 hotel rooms, and they're scattered out on that land. It's a place where we can be at 100% occupancy, and you may not see another guest. It's possible. It's just, you know, I sometimes walk to work and my traffic, quote unquote, is going to be turkeys and deer and, you know, wild quail. And it's unbelievable. There's, you know, active mountain lion in the area. I've had a bobcat literally run across my toe as he was trying to scamper across the path and literally run on my foot. It's an amazing place.
So it's good for social distancing then.
Yeah, we actually name it, we call it natural distancing, and that's it. I mean, it's perfect.
Oh, I like that. I mean, better than social distancing.
Yeah, just walk around and enjoy the redwoods by yourself, just because there's no one else around.
Yeah, well, you know, and I was the year when I was out at Pebble Beach, it was 2017, and I had a car and I drove as far down into Big Sur as I could. But at that year you had the floods and the bridge was closed. So I did a little, I mean, it's so gorgeous and it's what a place to work.
It is. And the part about Big Sur that's interesting is it's a strange combination. I mean, this is an area where obviously Henry Miller was here and, you know, Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth had their little love nest. What is Nepenthe now? There's this amazing artistic influence that has been here forever. But in addition, if you look back even further, this is a magical spot where the Esalen Indian tribe would stop every single year. They were nomadic people by nature, but this was one of the places they continued to come back to. There's something special about this place. And now you've got this wild bohemian culture and then venture capitalist type, you know, billionaire culture blending in one neighborhood.
Yeah. So what was your, let's say, day in the life pre-pandemic and now currently with the changes with COVID? And where are you guys at now with opening, or what happened with, was there a pause? I'll just segue that into just saying my question that I have from my last guest on episode 258. I had on Camilla Marcus, the founder of Westbourne in Manhattan, Soho. And she wanted to know if you could share what did happen when the pandemic hit, as she heard there were some amazing hospitality hero moments with guests who were stuck there, but really we were saying stuck in heaven. And she also adores the other guy. Well, so that's my big roundup question of like, how's it been going?
Well, let's say, okay, so the property itself, it's interesting. Because it's so small and it is relatively exclusive, it's supply and demand type thing. So we operated, you know, for, call it 5 months, 6 months out of the year at just a hair under 100%. Year-round occupancy was, you know, flirting with those numbers all year long. So it was full all the time. That's a great thing. And when you talk about wash, rinse, repeat, but it's something I've gotten used to with like the Alinea Group, where you have a product that's high demand, no matter what the price point, then people are going to clamor from around the planet to get there. So we were operating that way before everything. What we found as COVID started happening was just this uncertainty with what was going to happen next. And into, you know, January and February was nothing. But once the beginning of March hit, we started seeing, well, wait a second, there's more to this than anybody thinks. And we didn't know what was going to happen. And we kept trying to maintain every aspect of our property we could, because we are so spread out. So still maintaining the restaurant as we did. We started, the spa was still doing massage and so forth. The first thing we did was we shut down the restaurant, which would have been open to outside drive-in guests for lunch and dinner as well. But we made it exclusive for resort guests only. So that was the very first change we made. And then the restrictions started coming in from the state of California, from the county of Monterey, saying what we could and could not do. And we had to start, you know, cutting back. Spa services got cut back. What we could serve, what meals we could serve, and where we could serve them. Eventually got to the point where we could maybe do in-room dining only for our guests. Masks weren't a requirement at the time. But it got to the point where we just couldn't stay viable in just giving a product to our guests anymore. So March 24th, our last guest checked out of the, and we didn't open up again until July 15th. So it was a long stretch. Let's talk about where we are now. Where we are now is that we can't do any indoor dining in the state of California right now. So we have a small patio. We've been able to put 10 tables out there. We're trying to see if we can increase that number so we can have more of our hotel guests still dine even at the restaurant if they want to, albeit on the patio. We totally revamped our in-room dining services, so it's can be more comprehensive and more welcoming and warm and feel comfortable in the rooms. Something we did before, but we were able to expand on what we were doing and some of the selections. The spa services, we went from having massage that you could do in room. Now we can't do that. Massage that you could do in the spa, we can't do that either, because personal services are just not allowed right now in Monterey County. So we've found that we have contactless services, things like shamanism or sound therapy or astrology sessions. And these are things that we can do that kind of tap into the spa mentality without having to touch one another. Long-winded answer to a lot, but you, I don't know if you want me to address Camilla's question now, but I can.
Yeah, sure. I know. My question was long-winded, so you're allowed to have a long-winded answer.
That's fair. Well, part of what goes on in our property is Well, living in Big Sur, there's not a ton of housing. So I'd say about a third of our total employees live on property. With that, that means we have about 60 employees living on the property. In addition, we have their families. That means we have almost 40 kids on property as well. As we shut down, as the school shut down, that meant that we were having to entertain them or the parents were having to entertain their children here on property. As we started saying, okay, we're going to shut down services, deliveries to the area, they stopped coming. What do we do? How do we feed our employees? How do we make it so they feel safe? Our pivot was we decided to, even though the restaurant wasn't open, we decided to feed our employees. And so we kept a small amount of our kitchen team here working the entire closure. And we provided lunch every single day for anybody who's working, whether that be, you know, no matter what capacity they're in. But anybody working got lunch on us. And then dinners, we did dinners for the entire staff every night, anybody who was in employee housing. And so that continued every single month. And then we started having a lot of fun with it, which is where we started taking any managers that were around and having them do guest chef appearances. So for instance, I decided that Chinese takeout is something that we all missed. So I made a Chinese dinner. So I did fried rice and sweet and sour pork for staff meal for dinner one night. And it was just fun.
Yeah, and you could use that culinary background you have.
Exactly right. With a lot of help. It's been a lot of years since I've done that scale, but yeah, we pulled it off.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. So where are you at now with capacity, or is it typically extremely hard to get a reservation there? Or you know, how far in advance do people typically book? And are you booked now for the next couple of months? Or what is people's mindsets as well, you know?
The demand is really, really hard to explain. The easiest way is this. So in our standard, let's talk about a year ago, right? In the same period, we would have busy days, busy nights, our reservations team fielding any requests for future reservations. And they would close up shop for the night and they'd come back the next morning and field any voicemails they would have. And that number would be 4, maybe 5 voicemails from just the prior night. And we're talking not a lot of hours, we're saying 6 p.m. to 9 a.m. That's what they'd have overnight. About a month ago, they came in and they reached out to me to say, you won't believe this, but we're getting 85 to 90 voicemails overnight.
Wow.
Yeah, it's that kind of demand. Where we are is that, we're holding back our occupancy. We opened up on the 15th to roughly 35% occupancy, ramped it up to 50%. We're going to hit about 75% this next week. And that's where we're going to have to stick for now, not because of the amount of demand, but for a couple of other reasons. One, we've instituted new protocols, the cleanliness standards of sanitation, how many hours we take to do it, how many team members it takes to do all the different processes in order to take a room from occupied to, you know, vacant, clean, inspected, and ready for the next guest. So that just takes a little more time and effort. So we're holding our occupancy back because of that. Secondly, there were construction issues that we had done, and we had projects already in the works that we started in December and we're moving through, and those are supposed to be completed by Memorial Day. Well, when COVID-19 hit and all the shelter in place directives fell, then construction stopped at the same time, and we had to cease construction for months. Those same construction projects that were supposed to be done before Memorial Day are now not going to be done until after Labor Day. And so it just pushes everything out. So there's that natural kind of ceiling as to how many rooms we can occupy because they're still, you know, in the final stages of construction.
Yeah. It's hard. I hear you you just got to adjust on that. But what's this? I mean, your experiences and where you've worked. I mean, you've worked at such amazing, high demanding luxury properties. I mean, you know, the, like such intense, I would say, I would think these jobs that you've had are intense as having giving the hospitality experience. And, but you, I don't know, my roundabout way of saying, like, anything that you've been through, like, prepare you for this? Or was this like just something like none of us saw coming, and it was just, you know, figuring it out as we went?
Okay, what we're experiencing right now is completely unprecedented, and there's no other way around that. What I would say is this: when you work at a high level, when you're focusing on details, when you key on details, right? It helps you understand that you can only do one thing at a time, effectively. And let's go back to the Linde Group. It was Grant who actually said it one time. He said, "There's not a single thing that we do that by itself is difficult. What becomes difficult is how many of these simple things we compound." And are doing at the same time. Now, it's not that one person is doing them all. It's what you're doing is you have a variety of different people, a lot of different people, in the case of Alinea, doing small, individual, maybe simple tasks in concert with one another. And it's orchestrating all those pieces. So when you look at something like this, it's one, keying on what are the little minute details that need to happen. How do we key on the guest experience and make sure that it's proper from... how do we greet them at the gate? How do we make sure that they are safe, that the person working the gate is safe? How do we make sure that the person coming on understands what they're going to be driving into, given that we're going to have, you know, face coverings required in certain areas, that we're going to have social, physical, natural distancing requirements as they come on property, that they have the ability to, you know, park their own car if that makes them more comfortable, or we'll take care of it for them if they're more comfortable. That if they decide they don't want housekeeping services, you know, on a daily basis, that's okay with us, if that's okay with them. But if they change their mind, that's also fine. So what prepared me was that kind of minutia. I'd say also doing something as big as Pebble Beach Food and Wine, there was so much going on and so many balls in the air at once that a lot of what it came down to was staying calm, staying focused, understanding that, okay, what comes next? And when you have that sense of calm, you're able to approach the issues as you can and cross them off the list one by one by one, and hopefully get to a point where at least it feels like it's somewhat in control. Hospitality is a controlled crash. There's no two ways about it. Like, dumb things are going wrong all the time. The whole goal is to keep the things that are going wrong within the parameters that you set, so it isn't, you know, catastrophically wrong.
So. Yeah. Well said. Okay, so let's take a little break here, and we will come back and we'll play my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. We'll have my solo dining experience and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Dashable, an app created to help you find deals, discounts, and coupons for local businesses in New York City. Dashable will help you find the deals worth dashing for in a variety of categories, from food and drink to art, health, and pets. Support local and save money when you download Dashable today. That's Dashible.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Gary Obligacion. He is the general manager at Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California. And it's time for my speed round game. So, Gary, what this is I name a couple of things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Okay.
You ready?
I am ready.
Yeah, that's the sample one. You can answer it, but it's not required, even though there's no rules to this game either.
chocolate versus vanilla, I'd say chocolate, but it depends on if it's going to be forever or just right now.
Ooh, that's so interesting. How would you answer it if it's forever or if it's just like, what's the difference? What's right?
If it's, if it was one flavor forever, I'd actually choose vanilla.
Ah, so interesting. But right now you take chocolate. Okay.
Yes.
Cool. Well, let's see. Let's see how you answer the rest of these. Okay. Eat in or eat out?
Ooh. Before? Okay. It is eat in. Eat in is actually my preference. I love to cook. It is the way I release. It is my most relaxing. I would say this, though. It is a rare treat and truly fulfilling to eat out. And that's how I recharge my own batteries. When I really need to feel good, I go out and let myself be taken care of and surrender myself. So eating out.
Yeah. And I know this is supposed to be a speed round, but like, I wonder though, as I've heard this from other people who work in hospitality or chefs, like it's almost hard to relax if you're dining out because you notice things because you're a hospitality person. So you could, it's good that you're able to eat out and take it in and let people pamper you. So, okay, here, keep going. Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Oh, always champagne. I mean, I'll drink them all. Don't get me wrong. But if it's knee-jerk, champagne.
Great. Tasting menu or a la carte?
Ooh, you had to ask me that one, didn't you? Actually, for me, a la carte.
Okay.
I love tasting menus. I love executing for other people. I like eating a la carte myself.
Yeah. Well, it's good to know. Small plates or large plates?
Small.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Again, pre or post COVID?
What would be the difference for you on that?
Well, I don't know if I'd want to sit at a communal table at all right now. I'm not comfortable for that. And sitting in a group setting with people I don't know. There was a time where that was such a blast. It's just not right now. So chef's counter.
Yeah, that makes sense. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
I can go either way on that. I actually like having control of being able to tip. I also understand the need in certain environments to have it all-inclusive. So it depends on the circumstance, but I like being able to tip.
Okay. Walk-around tasting event or sit-down dinner?
Sit down.
Tablecloth restaurants or more casual settings?
Casual.
Two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Ooh. Can I have both?
You can have whatever you want.
I'd say both then.
I have a feeling at out in Big Sur that's the same goes. You can have both. You can have the cheese plate and the dessert.
Yes.
Okay, my last one's Manhattan, Brooklyn, Chicago, or Big Sur?
Ooh.
Did I stump you on that one?
Yeah, you did. Right now, Big Sur. It's all the above, but right now it's Big Sur.
Okay. Excellent. That was great. That was the game. So fun. It's so fun to hear what people, their preferences and get stuck on. And you're right though. These questions, what you would answer now compared to 5 months ago, it's a different mindset.
Well, and that's it. Even that last question is like, I used to take any excuse to get to New York. And right now, I can't wrap my head around leaving these redwoods. So,
well, I feel sheltered and safe. I'm here in Manhattan, so I can give you reports.
Perfect. That is absolutely perfect. We'll send photos back and forth.
Oh, that sounds great. Okay, so for industry news, picked out an article that was in the New York Times from their Australian reviewer. Her name is Besha Rodel, and the title of the article is "The Pandemic Could End the Age of Mid-Priced Dining." When Melbourne restaurants reopened after lockdown, owners got creative and dinner got far more expensive. She's talking about, you know, Australia is a bit ahead of us with opening, but then in this article, they said in July 8th that they went back on lockdown because of the virus. So, but she mostly talked about this restaurant, Liho Fook, about how they went to a new pricier tasting menu option post, you know, with the opening up of the pandemic, and just kind of, you know, questioning, is this what's going to be the future, that dining is going to be more expensive or more of a luxury experience, and the mid-priced we're not going to see as much of that. I thought it would be interesting to get your perspective of this.
I think there's going to be a trend to go that direction. I think you're right that the mid-priced restaurants are going to take a hit, and it's no different than when we saw the dot-com crash in San Francisco, where the neighborhood restaurants, the low end, got traction. The super, super high end got traction. The points in between took a beating. And that, I think it's going to be the same thing. There's a brand new restaurant that just opened in Chicago, since we're talking about it, and it's Ever, which is, you know, yeah, Curtis Duffy and Michael Muser, who had Grace, a Michelin 3-star. So they just reopened, and part of what's going on for them is, I think Chicago's at 50% maximum, maybe it's 25% maximum seating, but there's a cap. That's fine at the ultra high end. If you're doing a tasting menu that's, you know, $235, $255 per person, food only, and then everything starts getting added on, you're still making good revenue. And with this staggered seating, the distancing between tables that happens at 3-star level, it starts making sense to execute that way. Same thing if you're running a really low-end concept, you can have a counter service, walk-in, casual, drive-through windows, any number of things that make sense on the really low-end, fast casual type component. But if you're looking at the big bustling restaurants, tables super, super close together, packed in, the loud, boisterous, brasserie, bistro type things, I don't know how they exist at 25% capacity. They just don't, it's hard to make the numbers pencil out. No one's sure how it's going to, where we end up. I think that restaurants ultimately are going to look very close to what they did 6 months ago, but it may take about 5 years to get to a point they're recognizable the same way. There are also things that are being instituted, I think, right now that may never go away. And a lot of those things, so far as just the everyone's comfort level with sanitation, cleanliness, disinfection, it's just going to be different. Someone sneezes on an elevator now, I don't know what people are going to do.
Yeah, well, no, I think everything you said is very true. And I think in this article, I could see this as the future of how things are going to be. I've also been following along with what Alinea has done through this pandemic and their switch to the takeout the pickup service, and now they have the open air space they're doing. They found the rooftop to do their bring that to people. But I think you're right with fine dining. It's like you naturally have more space between tables and kind of that special exclusive like experience versus when, you know, that I think would works with social distancing.
Well, the interesting part you run into is at the very, very high end, a lot of the traffic for Michelin 3-stars in the United States, at least, is people flying in for dinner. It isn't neighborhood traffic. Mm-hmm. So with people not flying as much, with people not traveling out of state or internationally as much right now, that's a huge number of seats of guests that would normally be visiting these restaurants. So I know Alinea, the flagship, has not reopened yet, and I'm sure that's a factor playing into when they decide to reopen, is getting that fly in traffic again.
Yeah. That's the same with I'm thinking the restaurants in New York, like, you know, the EMPs and the Bernardins. It's a lot of tourists that typically go and support and want to, you know, be there. So we'll have to see what happens.
Absolutely.
When we get to that stage.
Yeah. The question becomes, do they even reopen?
Yeah. Well, that's also, I feel every day I hate to say it, it's like every day, but I'm reading about a closing of a dear special place for whatever reason. And it's very hard. I'm feeling for our industry, you know, it's tough times. And we also now in New York, you know, it's been interesting watching places doing outdoor dining and how New York has turned into a lot of, you know, there's all this patio seating everywhere. And it's definitely changed the look of the city. So we'll have to see how that progresses.
No doubt.
Okay, so it's time for my solo dining experience. So this week, I went to, it's actually from about, I'd say about a month ago, this experience, but I wanted to share it. So it's at F&F Pizzeria. So here's the rundown. The location, 459 Court Street, Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, New York City, in a converted garage between Frank's Wine Bar and Frankie's 457. The concept, it's a collaboration with legendary bakers Chris Bianco and Chad Robertson, serving a classic New York slice using the best ingredients and timeless techniques. So the owners are the Franks, Frank Castronovo and Frank Falcinelli of Frankie's Spuntino Group, and that includes Frankie's 457, Frank's Wine Bar, and now new, they opened up Frankie's Pantry and Bottle Shop. Why did I go? Well, this place was on my radar since it opened in October because of all the chefs involved. I wanted to check it out, and I hadn't gotten out there. So my experience, again, this was like late June. I have a client out in Industry City in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, called Gumption Coffee. And I went out there for a meeting. I took the train out there. It was my first time back on the train. And then afterward, I decided to bike back to Manhattan. And in doing so, passed through Carroll Gardens and stopped at this pizza place. I stopped to watch a sunset in Dumbo, but like I eventually made it home. So this place was on my route. So it worked perfectly. At the time, outdoor dining wasn't happening in New York. And they do have a lovely garden at Frankie's 457 that's now open. But they had takeout options. And I arrived and actually I saw the Franks were standing outside with friends. Everyone was wearing masks and social distancing. But it was cool to see this Brooklyn neighborhood vibe going on. I said hi. I went to the takeout counter at the front of these garage doors. I paid, I waited a few minutes for my pizza, and then I took it to a nearby playground and sat and ate in the shade. So what did I get? I had one regular slice of Bianco di Napoli tomato with Bianco di Napoli tomatoes, mozzarella, pecorino romano, and Sicilian oregano. And then I had one Sicilian square pie with its focaccia-like crust and had the same ingredients, but it also had Frankie's extra virgin olive oil. My take, they were delicious. I liked them both. I probably liked the square a little more. It had a really great crust on it, but I would get them both again. The ambiance, lovely Brooklyn neighborhood. I'd say it's perfect for pizza cravings. And I see they now deliver whole pies online, contactless delivery that you can get. Interesting tidbit, Pete Wells of the New York Times named F&F Sicilian Slice and Regular Slice one of his top 10 New York dishes of 2019. And personal fun fact, as I said, this was my first time in Brooklyn after the pandemic and my first time biking home over the Manhattan Bridge, which was really cool. I've become quite a biker now in this pandemic. It's been my primary way of getting around. The cost of this meal was $10, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes. Their website, franks.pizza, is their website. So there you go. Have you heard of the Franks and these guys, Gary?
I have, actually, and I can't, I'm dying to make it out there to try it myself.
Yeah, well, when you get back to New York, we'll go and we can go out there together. And maybe,
I would like
to go back and sit in their garden and have a meal. They have a really lovely, lovely spot. So
it's a date. Done.
Great. I love it. Something to look forward to. Okay, so it's time for the final question. My next guest is Akhtar Nawab. He is the chef and owner of Alta Calidad in Brooklyn and also of Otra Vez in New Orleans. And he's participating now in a new company called Cook Unity. And they have the Creators Club, which is, it's a new digital chef-to-consumer platform connecting culinary talent with consumers looking for an elevated at-home dining experience. So, Carrie, what would you like to ask Akhtar?
Well, what hit me when I was reading the bio on him is the New Orleans connection. And I remember talking to another chef from New Orleans who'd gone through Katrina. And what he described was that as the city of New Orleans was coming back from that, he got out on the street and he had a big pot of just red beans and rice. And he didn't have a ham hock. He didn't have an onion. It was literally just red beans and rice. Because what he tapped into was that as a chef, his desire was just to feed people. My question for Akhtar would be, what did he discover as a chef through COVID that he maybe didn't expect to, or that really surprised him, or what did he tap into from his own heritage, that be it the Indian side, the Mexican food that he's explored so fully, that will help carry him into this post-COVID era?
Awesome. I will find out. Great question. So that's the show. And wow, thank you so much for joining me. I'm in awe of your career and everything you've done. You're like the king of hospitality, and you've always made me feel so good whenever I've seen you. Like, you just bring, you have something about you that you bring your hospitality with you. So I'm glad you're doing well through this, and I wish you the best and everyone on your team, you know, we'll get through it.
Well, thank you, Sherry. Same to you. And I always enjoy seeing you. It's just been too long since we've seen each other in person. So let's figure out how, when we make that happen again.
I would love that. I know we're like the things like events are how I know you, and we don't have events right now. So.
And it may be a little bit, maybe a minute.
Yeah. We'll have to figure out more ways to connect, but this was great. And thank you so much for joining me. And I hope to see you soon.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate the conversation, and lots to think about no matter what. And it's just nice to share time with a friend. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. My guest today has been Gary Obligacion. He is the general manager at Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur, California. Their website is postranchinn.com. You can follow him on social media at Gary 0000. That's five O's. Count them out to make sure I got that right. And you can also follow at Post Ranch Inn. And you can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites, BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang, and thanks again to Gary. I'm Sherry Bayer. I will be back next week with another new show. I hope you'll tune in then. Be safe and be well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network
broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.